Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. I completely messed it up. Okay, welcome back, everybody. We are excited to be broadcasting in our post-Thanksgiving stupor.
Mm-hmm.
How was your Thanksgiving, Manton?
It was great. We stayed in town, just had a small family, eat as much as you can, watch lots of TV, and do nothing weekend, so it was good.
Nice. Yeah, we went to we went not far, about an hour and a half to some relatives who live in New Jersey, which was great because it was nice to just kind of get out there and see some of the really pretty parts of New Jersey and just sort of chill out, relax. You really do get, living in New York now, you do get that sort of instant relaxation factor from being places with open space.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a shocking thing. but it's good to be back and talking with you. And so what's been going on the last couple of weeks? We've been pretty good. We recorded, I think, only about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, things have been happening. You had something going on with the App Store, right?
Well, I had a couple things. I mean, the Mac App Store obviously is hitting, and so I've been preparing for that. And then I also had to scramble to push out a new Tweet Library bug fix update. Actually, I was working on a new version of Tweet Library for a while. I thought I had it good. I sent it to testers, and then, of course, at the last minute, I changed something, didn't test enough, and broke something. And actually, I mean, this is perfectly in line with what the listener question from last episode about how do you test and make sure the quality of your app is any good. Of course, after answering that question, I completely messed it up and shipped something that was broken on 3.2.1 and 3.2.2, but worked perfectly fine on 3.2 and 4.2. And of course, that was no good because 4.2 didn't ship for at least another week after the bug was introduced. So that was unfortunate. And it just, you know, I think the App Store, you know, I'm sort of getting used to it and what works well and what doesn't. What definitely does not work well is especially new apps maybe aren't quite as mature as they should be yet. If you have a bug, it's really difficult to push it out quickly and to react to problems because I emailed Apple asking for emergency, you know, push through of the bug fix. But even that, you know, there was the weekend and there's at least a couple of days before they see the email. So, you know, meanwhile, people are buying the app and there's nothing I can do about it. Now, I mean, it wasn't completely broken. It still worked, but it was a big enough problem in displaying tweets where I felt really terrible that people were spending their hard-earned $10 and having that problem that wouldn't be fixed for at least a few days.
Oh, God, that's so painful because you and I both know that feeling of a bug that's so bad you just want to get it out, like 10 minutes ago. And in that kind of situation, what I end up doing is I end up just like putting everything else on hold. I spend whatever the minutes, hours, days it takes to find and track down the bug. And then when I ship it, it's immediately off my chest. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, thankfully anybody else who downloads this now is not going to run into that.
Yep.
And of course, what you're describing is this situation where you have this delay, and it's just something to get used to, I guess. You know, I mean, obviously, our grandparents who were selling retail software in boxes, they had to deal with this on a much larger scale, right? But still, it's got something I've gotten used to. And then at the other end of the spectrum is web apps, right? Where there's never been a, unless it's a self-imposed company issue, it's even more easy to live fix your stuff because mm-hmm. users are constantly logging in to use the latest version, download the latest version every time they use the app. So,
sure.
I really see the appeal of that. And sometimes I think about, like, how can I make a Mac desktop app that is painfully, like, granularly constructed to update bits of it, you know, to try to get away mm-hmm. from the whole like rigid version structure. Kind of sounds appealing.
Yeah, I've actually, there's a couple things in Tweet Library that I've thought about driving from the server a little bit more. Some of the way the filters and the services for picture picture thumbnails and some things that are sort of, they're sort of dependent on assumptions in other sites, you know, like Flickr or whatever.
Right, right.
I've thought about driving some of those from the server more so that the app would check in and download a little config file to see if anything has changed in the real world and then adapt, just so that I can, you know, sort of more adapt to some of those kind of changes. But I haven't done that yet, but it's appealing to be able to just control bits of the app without actually pushing out a new software release.
That is a really good example. And with that kind of stuff, you know the user has a network connection or they're not going to be using mm-hmm. your app for anything right. useful anyway. And I have a very similar situation with the crossword app I sell called Black Ink. Mm-hmm. Its situation is similar in that it's sort of like a crossword scraping. You know, it's like it's finding puzzles at sites that offer them for free and then bringing them into the app to solve on your Mac. And that, I've thought the same kind of thing because I'm, you know, frankly, a lot of the updates are for little things like fix the New York Times, fix the Washington Post. And that's the kind of thing where definitely making it data-driven and making it something you could download automatically and like even silently over the web would be probably a better user experience. And especially now on the Mac and or on the iPhone. And then I have to start thinking this way about Mac software now, because obviously the App Store is going to have some of the same issues.
Yep.
But, you know, another thing I've noticed, as you know, I haven't really shipped much on the iPhone App Store. I don't really have that like visceral feeling of what it's like to have something on the store that you desperately want to update. And but even right now, I have apps submitted right now into the Mac App Store, and as I run into bugs in the current release of, say, Mars Edit, I'm realizing, what do I do? You know, this I understand now this confusion. Like I'm in review. I've been in review for, you know, a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. Do I reject the binary to update it with a better one? Or, you know, is it better to let them approve the worst binary and then update and up, you know, send an update? It's right. kind of like challenging. And one of the things I found myself thinking what was interesting was, and this is obviously, there's not really a corollary to this on the iPhone, but I realized since I do have so many customers out there running my current releases, it makes sense to me to at least stagger App Store updates by a couple days to make sure, you know, like I released 3.1.4 of Mars Edit. Now, let's say something happened and I realize, oh no, that version burns down houses, right?
Right.
So, if I've already submitted it to the App Store, sure, I can reject the binary, but I guess, you know, I guess as long as you can always reject the binary, there's not much risk of submitting it. But here's the thing. If you upload and they approve it, can you can't delete that version, can you? And have it forced back to the previous version?
No, there's no way. I looked, unless I missed something obvious, there's no way to revert back to a previous version. I think you can pull the app from the store.
But that sucks,
which,
right?
No, that's not good, right? I mean, that briefly crossed my mind, but the bug, I may say it was terrible, but I mean, it wasn't that terrible. I mean, the app, you know, it was not worth pulling the app from the store completely for. But yeah, I don't think there's any way to revert to a previous version, which would be
right.
awesome.
So
it was.
Just to totally, you know, underscore what I'm talking about here. Let's say you release 1.0, and it's a great app, and people are using it and loving it. And then you release 1.0.1 that has like a little tiny couple little bug fixes. Mm-hmm. And, oh, whoops, after running it for 2 days, it deletes your hard drive.
Right.
Yikes.
That's an upgrade from burning the house down.
Right,
so,
right. So
you're making progress.
So, of course, this sneaks past Apple's review process because they don't run the app for 2 days. Mm-hmm. Now you've got 1.0.1 live in the App Store, and you've got, you know, now that this app is burning the house down or deleting the hard drive. But you, as far as we can tell, you have a choice of sending Apple a 1.0.2 and having to wait a week maybe for that to go live.
Mm-hmm.
Or remove the app completely from sale.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm talking about is release the app first on the Mac to the public that can give you feedback while you still have the option of controlling the App Store, you know, versions. Because, if you found out right after you submitted 1.0.1 to the App Store, you could reject the binary. But if you find out right after Apple approves it, then you're screwed.
Yeah, I agree. I think that makes sense. The absolute last thing you want to do is hold your direct download Mac version until Apple approves the App Store. That would be madness, I think, to coincide.
Yeah.
I mean, you definitely push out what you have to your Mac customers that you can control the process with right away. And then I guess it's up to you whether you wait to hear back from them before submitting to Apple or just submit to Apple at the same time you upload to your own website. And then, you know, assume that Apple's going to take several days.
Right. That's the risk. Approve. That's the risk. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm going to end up doing just to have a little bit of sanity is because is at least wait a day because I have found generally when I screw something up big time, I find out within a day, you know?
Yep.
So.
Yeah. And I found out within an hour, you know. With this bug in particular. I mean, it was so stupid. The problem was I was testing almost all on 4.2 because I expected Apple to ship 4.2 on the iPad, you know, much sooner. And so I was doing almost all my testing on that. And my beta people, you know, were mostly on 4.2, although they didn't actually get the build that had this problem. But yeah, I found out like within an hour of this problem once the app went live. And then I fixed it within 10 minutes, but then I had to wait 4 days. So yeah, I think just padding an extra day, ship it to your Mac people, your direct download people, wait a day, then submit to Apple. That makes a lot of sense to me. And then if there is a really important thing that the, well, I guess you can't do that. I was going to say if there's some important fix that customers need, you can point them to the website, but you can't really do that if they bought it in the App Store. They won't be able to do much with the direct download version.
Right, unless you come up with some special way of granting them privilege because of their App Store receipt or something.
That would be interesting, actually, looking for other copies of Mars Edit that have the receipt.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of stuff to try out, and I'm going to be looking forward to seeing what other developers do because I have my ideas, but I'm sure that you know other people have different ideas and see what we can all come up with collaboratively. So speaking of bugs, boy, I guess bugs are on my mind because sometimes you have a bug that is so terrible, and as we were saying, you know, you find out within an hour or you find out within a day, and sometimes you have a bug that is still kind of insanely terrible, but you don't find out for months, and not even because everybody's not running into it, but just because nobody's really noticing it. And I had this bug, it turns out, with Mars Edit. And you know me, Manton, you know I am like a kind of almost a jerk about memory leaks and writing correct code and doing the right thing. And I'm not one of these guys who's like, oh, what's a few hundred K here and there, you know, leaked to the system.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't have this trait in like keeping my desk clean or keeping my office clean. But when it comes to memory and resources used by code, I kind of want everything to be neat and tidy. So imagine my horror when I discover that every time you open and close a Mars Edit window, it's leaking like 300K or maybe more. I had some people say more, and there might be other issues going on there. But here's what happened. I never noticed this because I was using, call me crazy, but I was using leaks analysis tools. And I thought, come on, if there's a real serious problem here, it's going to show up. And what I neglected to do was ever pay attention to simply what's the total RAM usage of my app and is it going up on a regular basis? And fortunately, I had some users kind of like drive the message to me like, no, seriously, this is using too much RAM. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, that's just WebKit. I finally had to sit down and say, what are the actual bytes here that are being allocated on a regular basis? And I was ignorant of some of the new tools, or maybe even not that new, but part of that whole realm of instruments where I'm still kind of getting my feet wet.
Yeah.
Because I was a big Malloc debug and Shark guy, right? And instruments, I think it's powerful, but I still just kind of am unsure about what it can do for me in some cases.
Right.
So this well-timed post from Bill Bumgarner talked about it, a situation just like this. And it was Leaks says there's no leak, but every time I open and close a document, what do you know? The RAM usage goes up. So what's really cool about that blog post is he talked about this feature in the allocations instrument, and it lets you basically click a button to do a so-called heap shot. And then what that does is it only shows you from there on new allocations. And furthermore, it will, as you do consecutive heap shots in the future, it will only show you for those previous heap shots any of the bytes of RAM that are still allocated. So that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But then furthermore, you go in and you start examining this stuff, and it shows you, you know, for Cocoa objects, it shows you right there in the list of objects what the name of the object is. So you can go scanning, for example, for object classes that don't look like system classes. Like, I discovered that there's some stuff that's just sort of like reflects the magic going on behind the scenes, you know, NS image doing caching or whatever, fonts, menus doing caching. But you see a big, you know, in my case, RS HTML edit view. And it's like, that's not Apple's.
Yeah.
There is still a chance that it's Apple's fault that it's being retained, but probably not.
Mm-hmm.
So then the whole process of just tracking down, why isn't this thing getting de-allocated? You know, at this point, it's the same investigative process as with a real memory leak, a so-called real memory leak.
Mm-hmm.
So for some reason, this object is being retained by something, and furthermore has a reference to that object in memory that is causing Leaks to think it's not a real memory leak. So usually this kind of thing comes down to retain cycles, where you've got like object A is retaining B and object B is retaining A. So as far as Leaks can tell, they're both supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, it took me a few days of doing this, but I was, as we were saying, I was anxious. And here's what's funny. This is the sickness and the superpower of being a conscientious developer. As I said, nobody really, on the big scheme of things, nobody complained about this. It turns out this bug was new in 3.0, so nobody has seriously complained about this for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I find out about it, and it's like, I want the bug fixed and shipped 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't stomach the fact that this is out there, and that people, even if it's only one or two people, some people are finding the memory usage not palatable. And it gets worse, obviously. Here's the funny thing. A few of the people had a good enough sense of humor that they would say, obviously, when I quit and restart Mars Edit, the memory goes back to normal. And they said, I guess it's a testament to Mars Edit stability that it can run for weeks, and so now it's using hundreds of megabytes of memory. So anyway, this put the fire under me. I wanted to fix this as soon as possible, so I spent days fixing it. I tested it. Sent it out to my testers, but after that, it was like I could not get it up there fast enough. So I shipped that earlier this week, and then of course, as usual, it's just the crossing the fingers, hoping you didn't screw something up. But I can't imagine, you know. I mean, this is a relatively minor thing. I was able to kind of talk myself down, like it's not a big deal. I can spend a couple more days working on this because nobody's really caring about it too much. But if it was something burning the house down, then I would be frantic to get it up.
Yep.
And I just can't imagine. I think what I'll have to do if I get into that situation with the App Store is I will have to pull the app from from the store completely. Because man. I can't have something.
Yeah.
I mean, with the memory usage thing, I would let that stay. And for example, the version I have submitted right now has the memory usage problem. So if Apple goes live with the App Store and it contains this, I'll just update. I'll send them the update, but then I'm fairly happy with people buying this and trying it out. Mm-hmm. But if it was something more serious, I don't know. Just it would pain me. So
the where I would draw the line is a data loss problem. I mean, you joked about deleting the hard drive, but that is, if it's a data loss problem, that is worth pulling, I think, because that has lasting damage. If it's a cosmetic problem or a minor bug or a crash, you know, it's hard to justify pulling it. But I know what you mean. It's frustrating to have the fix in your hands, especially. And then like once you have the fix done, but no one in the rest of the world has it, it's like you're just really anxious. Like I have the fix, it works. Everyone else has the bug.
Yeah.
Everyone that buys it today has the problem. You know, it's a really frustrating experience. But yeah, pull it. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm just going to, yeah, I hope this doesn't happen to me again. And I definitely don't want to be emailing Apple ever again and saying, oh, I'm sorry, please rush the approval of this. I mean, because that's definitely crying wolf kind of thing at some point. But the kind of bugs that are so serious that you need to rush a bug fix update out, they don't happen very often. I mean, it's been a long time since I've had one of these. And I think we just have to be more careful. And like you said, push for Mac App Store releases, push it out to everyone else first and give it some time to bake. All right, so we're recording in December. This is probably going to be the last show before the holidays again. And I wanted to quickly give a plug for another Mac developer conference that's coming up. We talked last time about 360 iDev, and I really had a good time at that conference. It was the first one I'd been to, and they're doing a Mac-focused one, kind of the same, but all about the Mac in Denver, December 10th to 11th. I guess that's less than 2 weeks, but they still have tickets. And I almost, after 360 iDev, I had such a good time, I almost considered going to 360 Mac Dev, even though I had completely said I'm not going to travel because, you know, I'm doing stuff with the family like the next week and it just didn't work out timing wise. But I almost considered changing my mind and going because I had a really good time and I think this would be a lot of fun. So I'll link that up in the show notes, but definitely anyone who's interested in squeezing in one more conference, or maybe they haven't been to any of the recent ones, 360 Mac Dev is coming up in Denver and it should be fun.
Yeah, it's. I would have really liked to have gone to this. I think my schedule is just too packed this year. But
yeah,
this. What's the name of the? It's like a husband and wife team or something that puts this on. Is it
John Wilker? I think
John Wilker. Yeah,
the main guy. Yeah. You know, I met him for the first time really briefly at WWDC, and then just kind of talked to him a little bit in passing at 360 iDev. Not much, but I like his approach. I mean, he seems to. And he's done at least a few of these now. And I think before the 360 iDev, he maybe did some Flash.
Oh, okay. So he came with experience.
Maybe. I'm not, to be honest, I wasn't paying close attention. But I like his approach. It's reasonably priced. He seems to have his heart in the right place. And one of the things that I really liked also at the end of the conference in the closing session, he put up slides like being completely transparent about how much the conference costs to run, you know, how much it's making and that kind of thing. So I like the openness of that. It was really refreshing. So I hope this one does well, and I definitely would like to go to one next year.
Yeah, I think we're just so lucky. I mean, I think I only really know him from some Twitter back and forth. He's Jay Wilker on Twitter, if anybody wants to catch up with him. But just seems like we're so lucky on the Mac right now. We have so many of these kind of like community-minded people.
Yeah.
And the iPhone, obviously what he's doing does not just apply to the Mac. He started mainly doing iPhone stuff, iOS conferences. Just recently I was talking to Scotty again about you know, all the stuff he does, and I'm just thinking, you know, my friend Ed Marchak here in New York who put on that Mac Tech conference. It's like we're sort of like swimming in. And of course all the Chicago guys put on the second conference. It's like it's kind of like insane, right? How many options we have. And I hope it's not so much competition, you know, friendly competition, but competition nonetheless. I hope it's not so much that none of the conferences is doing well enough, but it seems like they all basically are doing well enough. So it's really exciting, really cool. And I'm definitely interested to check out one of these 360 conferences as well when I get a chance.
Yeah, we'll have to see if next year there are as many, because there certainly were a whole bunch this year between NS Conference, MacTech, 360, the Chicago one. The only thing I'm kind of curious about a little bit is that it splits the community a little bit in a weird way. And maybe the community is too big that it can't help but be split. But when you have sort of regional conferences, or you have, like, I'm only going to this one and not this one, mm-hmm. you know, you'll have some overlap, but come on, most people can't go to all the conferences, or most people can't even go to, you know, more than one. And so I think you have different, it carves out different parts of the community.
It's true. Yeah.
And it was really refreshing. I mean, I met a whole bunch of iPhone people at 360 iDev that I had never met before. Some people I'd never even heard of before, and they turned out to be really great people and really interesting and gave good talks and whatnot. But so that was really refreshing. But at the same time, I miss a little bit the way it was when you just had kind of one conference where everyone went, and you know, you could be guaranteed to hook up with someone that you saw the previous year.
Yeah. And what's kind of interesting is, as you said, there seems to be a huge regional component at all of these different conferences. Mm-hmm. I neglected to mention again, another asset is the Voices That Matter conference. And, that just sprang to mind, because when I went to the Philly one for them, it was a lot of local people to the Philly area. But what's interesting is, because there's so much reuse of the same speakers, right? There's kind of some speakers have kind of come into being regulars at not just one of the conferences, but many of them. Mm-hmm. And so there's sort of like this core of speaker community and then attendee community. And of course, they all mesh perfectly because we're all nerds. But I just thought that was kind of interesting. Like, you know, I went to Voices That Matter and I saw Mike Lee, and then I went to MacTech in LA, you know, across the country, and I saw Mike Lee, and it's like, right. Mike is sort of...
He gave a different talk, right?
I think it was the same talk.
Oh, okay, because I was going to say, I thought he gave a different talk at this 360 iDev, and I think he's giving a different talk.
Okay, he might be, yeah.
But it sounded different, but I completely agree. There's a lot of speakers that have been going to all of them, although I think he's the only one that I know that is actually speaking at every
He's kind of on a pilgrimage, I think, so...
Yeah.
More power to him.
Oh, his talk, he completely nailed his talk at 360 iDev. I was impressed.
Awesome. Okay, Manton. Well, let's get back to our listener Q&A, because I love this part of the show. Get to hear from you, our listeners. If you have had something on your mind and you want to be marginally famous on Core Intuition, just send us a note and ask us your question. We have one here from Marcus Carlson. This was sort of a excerpt, I think, from an email to us. And he was expressing that he was a little worried and concerned about the sense that Mac developers are disdainful of the GPL licenses. And he makes a point. He says he calls into question the idea that Mac developers think that somebody else choosing the GPL is somehow harmful to their business. And then he says, I'm not going around whining about that I can't incorporate parts of Mars Edit or Clipstart in my product. Now, if those products were licensed under GPL, that wouldn't change. I still wouldn't go around and complain that they were not free enough. I find this whole crusade on GPL code unhealthy. What do you think about that, Manton? Because I agree with the sense Marcus has that in the Mac community, myself included, you're more likely to find people who are sort of anti-GPL, or at least not interested in using GPL.
Yeah.
Is that because we are a more commercial oriented market? Is it because we just, or is it because we just have like a political opposition to GPL?
Yeah, he makes a really good point, but I do think it stems a lot from the commercial aspect. I mean, and that's really how your hands are tied, right? I mean, you have an existing commercial product. You'd love to use some GPL code. You have to be very, very careful. Either you can't at all, or as we've discussed on the show, I mean, there's, you know, with LGPL and, you know, depending on how you use it, maybe you can use some of it. But I think that's where my feeling mostly comes from. And I mean, it is, he makes a good point though. Cause I mean, for example, how much code have I open source, you know, to contribute back to the community? Almost nothing. Right. So, I mean, I shouldn't be talking, I shouldn't be definitely criticizing people. They're releasing source code regardless of what license. Thank you for releasing it. You know, I mean, he makes a really good point there. My one thing, well, I'll take one example that I have used extensively in my products. That's GPL, as maybe a counter to some of what he's saying, which is the FFmpeg project with, you know, full of video and audio codecs and doing movie conversion and that sort of thing. That is GPL or LGPL. A project of that size is very difficult to do on your own. It's impossible for me. I don't have the expertise to build something like that. I'd have to go find several or more people to try to build something of that scope, or even if not that scope, at least the pieces I needed from that. And so I think by putting something out like as GPL, it discourages other people from, you know, reinventing the wheel and coming up with something new just so that it's licensed under MIT or, you know, something else. And so that's one problem, I think, especially with large scale GPL projects. So it's like you have this massive project and, you know, it's out there. It's just not worth anyone's time to build another version that is not GPL license. So that code is kind of permanently trapped under GPL. For smaller bits of code, it's not an issue. I mean, you know, worst case, you have to write your own version.
Yeah. You know, you're saying that you have no problem with the free choice that the FFmpeg contributors made to license their code under GPL, but you just find it very unfortunate that they sort of like claimed the ground of being the big project that's going to tackle this. And because somebody has claimed that ground, another team of like aspiring developers is less likely to sort of pick that as their battle.
Yeah, it would just be a huge battle. It would take a bunch of people and it's just not worth it. I mean, that project is very mature. Unless there's, it comes out, you know, that there's just a better way to do things,
right.
You know, something, for example, like WebKit versus Mozilla comes to mind. It's like, you know, everyone's kind of surprised at first when Apple was building their web browser and it wasn't based on Mozilla, especially since they had hired, you know, at least one Netscape engineer over. But it turns out that was brilliant because they built a much better platform for that technology. But that was backed by Apple, right?
Right, I mean, still, and it's still a huge
completely
team, right?
Outside the scope. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I would like to step back and just respond to Marcus's question. For myself, I think I strongly agree with what Marcus is saying, that there is no distinction between a developer choosing to release their work under GPL license or developers like myself and Manton choosing to release our work under a proprietary license that can only be used under binary form after a payment of a license fee. I think that, I mean, as far as, you know, our rights to choose that and controlling where our code goes and under what legal circumstances it can be used. No, I cannot judge a person who believes strongly in the GPL and decides to release their code that way.
Right.
However, there's two problems I have with the GPL that come to mind. I'm sure there are more. There are two that come to mind. The first is GPL has such a strong brand in the open source community that people will choose GPL ignorantly without understanding the pros and cons of how it applies to their work. Now, granted, this may be less of an issue now. I think there has been a lot of education in the past several years, and also my experience of this is anecdotal, but how many times have you met developers who have released code open source and you ask them, why is it GPL? And they say, I don't know, that's just what everyone said I should do, or that just seemed like it was the most popular. And you know what those answers sound like? They sound like the reasons people give for choosing to run Windows, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not that I don't think they have the right to make the choice. It's that I think often they're making the wrong choice. And not just the wrong choice for me, not because I necessarily want to take their code and run with it, but because I think if they sat down and had all the facts, often many of the people I've run into do wish, in retrospect, that they had chosen a more liberal license for their code.
Yeah, and you touched on something, sort of the philosophy of this whole thing, and another thing that's annoying to me, and again, it's their right to do it, but the free software sort of, you know, term that's thrown around where, you know, for example, there was a thing on the Free Software Foundation website that says, "We demand software freedom now." It's like, you know, it's on this crusade, got to have free software. And obviously they're implying that GPL software is more free than another open source license, which, you know, you can definitely make an argument that that's not true, that software, that another license that's more open that would allow commercial developers, for example, to use it and contribute back, is more free. You know, I mean, who knows? I mean, you can define it different ways, but there's definitely this crusade aspect to
right.
the free software movement that it's a little bit annoying.
And, well, and that is the politicization of the issue
right.
on the part of GPL. The GPL's primary promoters is what sort of, I think, demands a political opposition. So there's a reason for people like myself to feel philosophically opposed to the GPL, precisely because, you know, they're promoting it not just as a practical choice for developers, but as, you know, it's understandable, I think, for people like myself and other people who are turned off by the GPL to get riled up when you're facing a movement where they don't just say it's a choice, where they say their goal is to have all code in the world fall under this license. Right. And say what you will. Sure, it's their choice, but if they're going to make that their mission, I'm going to make it my mission to call out every fault I see in their yep. stance and in their approach and in what it is doing to the developer community. So I've got a couple posts about this, actually, that I will add to the show notes. One of them where I talk about what it means to be free, because what you were just saying really hits on that. Like, free, the definition of free really depends on who you ask and what, you know, what the circumstances are. And then another post I have, which basically is just my best shot at totally reaming the GPL. So, you know, one last thing I'll just say here in response to Marcus. I said that there were two things that popped to mind. There was the first, which is that I think a lot of developers aren't really making a conscious, well-informed choice when they choose the GPL. The other thing is the fact that somebody else has the choice to do something does not in any way remove my right or ability to judge it disdainfully. For example, billions of people go to McDonald's, right? That is their choice. Do I think it's an elegant, aesthetic experience that I want to hold up as, like, you know, the model for how all food service should be run? No. Right? So
yeah.
Just because somebody has chosen to do something and it was their free choice to do it doesn't mean that I have to celebrate or endorse it. And in fact, it leaves plenty of room open for me to denigrate it and try to persuade other people not to make the same choice. That's my rant. I'm sticking to it.
Well, we could go on about GPL for quite some time. Maybe we'll bring it up again.
I think it may be in honor of this show, this show's topic. Maybe we should license this episode under the terms of BSD. So, folks, feel free to reuse this show, give proper attribution. Thank you very much.